The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Welcome, welcome everyone to Tango Radio Show, brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, David Wren, a.k.a. Dave from L.A. Just want to thank you all for listening today. And today is January the 29th, 2016. It's a Friday. We have a live show for you today. Looking forward to bringing you this show. And I just want to say before we get started, everyone continue to support Black Talk Radio Network and all of the programs that are here. And also make monetary donations, donate your time, your professional services, and anything that you can do to help grow this network. It is so important that we take care of and nurture this network into its full fruition so that it can provide for many, many more. Not only just you, but the people that names in which you do not know. It's so important that we take care of what is taking care of us, because there are no other outlets that are really specifically designed to cater to our needs and to bring issues to the forefront that we can decide on a direction that we will take individually and as a family members and as a collective body in itself. So important that we continue to support. You must try to do something this week, try to do something today, try to do something next week in order to make sure that Black Talk Radio Network is still here and bringing you the great information why and the reason why you listen in daily. So please continue to do that. Also, you can follow Tando Radio Show on Facebook, T-H-A-N-D-O Radio Show on Facebook. And check us out there. While you're there, like the page and then check out some of the articles. And if so deemed, share them and like and comment there. If you like, and you can also send a message to me there on Tando Radio Show. So let's go to Tando Radio Show real quick and look at some of what's in the news today and what we posted. Didn't post a lot today, was very busy, but we will get to what it is. Okay, first one comes from Newsweekly.com. Scientist calls for the death of humanity. This really good article. Check this one out. It's a little old, but it's still telling you everything, because you're starting to see different things starting to play out that actually substantiate and validates what is really going on and what the agenda really is. So check that out. Good article. Next, we have Bank of Japan stuns the market with surprise move to negative interest rates. Once again, you know, the market loves that, but there is a downside to that. The overall debt bubble will continue to explode. And, you know, this is some of the things that we talk about here. Very important. This tells you that you definitely need to be preparing, because at some point, at some time, they're going to make you pay for what is owed and what they consider is due. So that was one of the articles, and that one was from Bloomberg, I believe. Reuters. That was from Reuters. Next, we have from Sputnik News, Belgium to Greece. Just push them back to the sea to solve the migrant problem. That is what Belgium, and if you know the history of Belgium, and specifically and particularly with people of color, the melaninated people of the world, it doesn't surprise. And and know the history of Belgium and what their very with their emphasis is within the financial world, it makes all of the sense, because this is the overall sentiment of humanity in general, and Belgium definitely exemplifies that. So check out that article, really good one. Also from this one comes from RussiaInsider.com. This one's article that they had, or posting that they had, Obama is a murderer banner hung opposite the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Check that one out also. Next we have, this is very, very important for our young people and our young, especially our, you know, all of our young people that have been misdiagnosed as to needing some form of synthetic drug to balance out their mental stability. So this one says, and this comes from Daily Mail, suicide risk to teens who take antidepressants. Very, very important. Parents, please understand, know what's really going on, and because there is an agenda that's being perpetuated and being pushed forward, that you need to protect your family, especially our young people, because that is your first responsibility, is to protect and provide for our young people. So check out this article, and just wrote, no child should be exposed to these type of dangers, which can lead to a lifelong dependency on the pharmaceutical prison, because that's what it will be. Next, we have from naturalblaze.com, new task force guidelines call for screening every adult pregnant woman for depression. Man, this stuff is ridiculous. Check out that article that's there. Also, this one comes from JapaneseTime.com, .jp, and it says, food banks spring up in Japan to match food waste with nations hidden poor. Now, let me tell you something. Let me tell you, if they didn't have different assistance programs and they try to hide what the real economic ramifications are and what the real economic economic indicators and the adverse side of the of a down economy is that they have different food banks and different assistance programs, and if they didn't have those assistance programs, there would be no need. I mean, you would totally understand how dire the overall situation is here and in other countries. They hide what's really going on by these programs, but these programs are going to be insufficient for what's coming. And one of the things with these programs is that they purposely do them not because they care, but it's another measure of control, and it's another measure into which to get people to respond the way that they want to at the appropriate time. So check out that article just to let you know what's happening. Also, next one comes from RT. BRIC gets greater say in IMF. BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and that is going to grow in countries and overall. There's a reason why those countries are within the BRIC nations, are the foundation of the BRIC nations, and this is what we talk about in our membership class, and you should know also. So check that out. Really good article. Tells you everything where things are going economically or how they're going to play out. Next we have my man Brother Braggs posted a nice little picture of just a small portion of his library. He said, just left the lab. Peace, my man Brother Braggs. So my man, that now you know why Brother Braggs is so wise. Look at all those books. And read the lion's share of them, I know. So next we have coming from, got this one from YouTube, Iran says it flew drone over U.S. carrier, and I believe it was a submarine also. Check that out. Pretty telling, but tells everything. Not good at all. So then we have, this is a great video. We'll talk about this later, and it's a part of what Scotty was talking about in his show today that I caught the last part of. And sorry about that, Scotty. I laughed because of what you said and didn't mean to interrupt your show. But YouTube video, tearing down Detroit, demolishing the houses for the economy. Man, these people are ruthless in this whole thing. And we're going to talk about this. They're allowing the infrastructure to deteriorate because of there is a reason why. Because they don't plan on those individuals being there and they want to tear it down. Why? So that they can rebuild it, and those that rebuild are going to profit from what was set up in a way and it was purposely done. Same thing in Flint. You know, Scotty was talking about and made so many great points on what's going on in with the water situation. That infrastructure, as well as all the infrastructure throughout this country, is falling apart, and it's purposely allowed to fall apart because they have, as the song goes, they have money for wars but can't feed the poor. This is what's really going on, is they allow the infrastructure to deteriorate so that they can leverage it in the way that they can. That whole infrastructure falling apart was intentionally done, and they're culpable from the government itself, the city, the state, the utility companies. They take your payment, but they can't ensure that the product that they're bringing is safe for you. So they're culpable for what they were bringing to you. And there's no way in the world that that is not an issue that should not be addressed from a standpoint of liability. They are liable for what they've done. And this is more than a tort. This is a criminal act. And a tort is, you've heard of misdemeanors and felonies. Well, a tort is when you do something knowing that because of what you're doing in business, it can cause harm to someone. It's like if you're a painter and you have a ladder and there's a bunch of kids in the house and you have a can of paint on top of a ladder and you walk away from the ladder unsupervised and a child runs and hits that ladder, that was a tort that you've done. And this is more than a tort because the intent behind this shows criminal intention to get people ill. Because they knew what was coming through those pipes, and they knew the overall state of those pipes and how long that they've been in existence and what happens when they overextend their life capacity. So they're culpable in all of this, and they because they knew that this could happen, and they did nothing about it. And they're still doing nothing about it as we speak to not only remedy the problem, but also to fix what they've caused as far as reestablishing the people back to better than what they were before, physically, mentally, and economically, because they've actually been paying for their own poison. There is some real liability that's there, and it should be, not only should they be held accountable, they should be held liable. And that's the direction that needs to, because then they will continue to do what they've been doing for so long. So those were the articles. Didn't post much today. Was very, very busy. But we're going to get into today's show. Now, today's show, we're going to talk about capital controls. What are they? Why is it? What is it and how it is and will affect you in the future? So very, very important. And also, we're going to give you an introduction. My man Corbett has a great video out on what the actual banking situation has been established under. So we're going to definitely put that together. So at any time today after the video, we're going to talk about the capital controls and what they are. You give us a call, 641-715-3660, and the participant code is 549032#, and hit *61. And also, if you have any other questions or comments about anything else, it's Friday. Definitely jump in, and we will be here. My man, Brother Braggs, is already in queue. So we're going to jump to this video because it's very, very important. I'm not going to play the whole thing, but we're going to play some of it and then come back and talk about capital controls and then give you an idea of why this is so, so important. This whole thing is intentionally falling apart. The domino effect is going on as we speak because someone pushed the first domino and they're all starting to fall. So you're listening to Tando Radio Show. Brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. I'm going to jump straight into this video and get going. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about have a dialogue about what it is that's going on. Why is this so important? So that we can move on to the things that we really need to be doing. So, let me see where this video is. Oh, maybe Scotty wouldn't.
I'm going to have to play it for you. The file was too large for me to get uploaded to the switchboard.
Okay. So, okay. Hey, Scotty, let's play just the first 45 minutes of it.
Okay, first 45 minutes. All right, here we go.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Scotty.
Hi, I'm Buck, your personal tour guide to the Federal Reserve. I'm here to introduce you to one of the most complex but effective institutions in the United States. But don't worry, I'll explain it all in plain English. Just beside me is a roadmap of where we're going. Together, we'll walk through the Federal Reserve System, literally. And along the way, I'll show you just what goes on around here and why it's important. By the end of this tour, you too will be able to explain the Federal Reserve in plain English.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
That would effectively be a takeover of monetary policy by the Congress, a repudiation of the independence of the Federal Reserve, which would be highly disruptive to the stability of the financial system, the dollar, and our national economic situation.
The Federal Reserve does not own any gold at all. We have not owned gold since 1934.
All our lives, we've been told that economics is boring. It's dull. It's not worth the time it takes to understand it. And all our lives, we've been lied to. War, poverty, revolution. They all hinge on economics, and economics all rests on one key concept. Money. Money. It is the economic water in which we live our lives. We even call it currency. It flows around us, carries us in its wake, drowns those who are not careful. We use it every day in nearly every transaction we conduct. We spend our lives working for it, worrying about it, saving it, spending it, pinching it. It defines our social status. It compromises our morals. People are willing to fight, die, and kill for it. But what is it? Where does it come from? How is it created? Who controls it? It is a remarkable fact that, given its central importance in our lives, not one person in 100 could answer such basic questions about money as these.
So if you were planning a family, you'd want to know where babies come from.
Yeah.
And this is a lot about banking. So let me ask you, where does money come from?
Where does the money come from?
Where does any money...
The government prints it. Print it off.
Where does money come from?
How is new money created?
By labor. People work and produce wealth, and the money is supposed to match that wealth.
Where does money come from?
Well, I have a pretty different outlook on money. It actually comes from, like, trees, right?
But why is this? How could we be so ignorant about a topic of such importance? Where does money come from is a basic, childlike question. So why is our only response the childlike answer, meant as a joke, "It grows on trees"? Such a profound state of ignorance could not come about naturally. From the time we are children, we are curious about the world and eager to learn about the way it works. And what could lead to a better understanding of the way the world works than a knowledge of money, its creation and destruction. Yet discussion of this topic is fastidiously avoided in our school years and ignored in our daily life. Our monetary ignorance is artificial, a smokescreen that has been erected on purpose and perpetrated with the help of complicated systems and insufferable economic jargon. But it doesn't take an economist to understand the importance of money. Deep down, we all know that the wars, the poverty, the violence we see around us hinges on this question of money. It seems like a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle just waiting to be solved. And it is. The puzzle pieces, taken together, create an image of the Federal Reserve, America's central bank, and the heart of the country's banking system. Despite its central importance to the economy, relatively few have heard of it, and fewer still know what it is, despite the bank's attempts at self-description.
Our economy runs on a complex system of exchange of goods and services, in which money plays a key part. Coin, currency, savings, and checking accounts, the overall supply of money is managed by the Federal Reserve. Money is the medium through which economic exchanges take place, and money as a standard of value helps us to set prices for goods and services. The job of managing money, monetary policy, is to preserve the purchasing power of the dollar while ensuring that a sufficient amount of money is available to promote economic growth. The Federal Reserve also promotes the safety and soundness of the institutions where we do our banking. It ensures that the mechanisms by which we make payments, whether by cash, check, or electronic means, operate smoothly and efficiently. And in its fiscal role, acts as the banker for the United States government. Now, these duties comprise the major responsibilities of our central bank.
But in order to really understand the Federal Reserve, we must first understand its origins and context. We must deconstruct the puzzle. The first piece of that puzzle lies here, in the White House. This is where the Federal Reserve Act, then known as the Currency Bill, was signed into law after passing the House and Senate in late December 1913. The New York Times of Christmas Eve 1913 described the festive scene. The Christmas spirit pervaded the gathering. While the ceremony was a little less impressive than that of the signing of the Tariff Act on October 3rd last in the same room, the spectators were much more enthusiastic and seized every occasion to applaud. There in the White House that fateful December evening, President Wilson signed away the last veneer of control over the American money supply to a cartel, a well-organized gang of crooks, so successful, so cunning, so well hidden, that even now, a century later, few know of its existence, let alone the details of its operations. But those details have been openly admitted for decades. Of course, just as we have been taught to find economics boring, we have been taught that this story is boring. This is the way the Federal Reserve itself tells it.
The United States was facing severe financial problems. At the turn of the century, most banks were issuing their own currency, called banknotes. The trouble was, currency that was good in one state was sometimes worthless in another. People began to lose confidence in their money, since it was only as sound as the bank that issued it. Fearful that their bank might go out of business, they rushed to exchange their banknotes for gold or silver. By attempting to do so, they created the panic of 1907.
During the panic, people streamed to the banks and demanded their deposits. The banks could not meet the demand. They simply did not have enough gold and silver coin available. Many banks went under. People lost millions of dollars. Businesses suffered, unemployment rose, and the stability of our economic system was again threatened.
Well, this couldn't go on. If the country was going to grow and prosper, some means would have to be found to achieve financial and economic stability.
To prevent financial panics like the one in 1907, President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into law in 1913.
But this is history as told by the victors, a revisionist vision in which the creation of a central bank to control the nation's money supply is merely a boring historical footnote, about as important as the invention of the zipper or an early 20th century hula hoop craze. The truth is that the story of the secret banking conclave that gave birth to that Federal Reserve Act is as exciting and dramatic as any Hollywood screenplay or detective novel yarn, and all the more remarkable for the fact that it is all true. We pick up the story, appropriately enough, under cover of darkness. It was the night of November 22, 1910, and a group of the richest and most powerful men in America were boarding a private rail car at an unassuming railroad station in Hoboken, New Jersey. The car, waiting with shades drawn to keep onlookers from seeing inside, belonged to Senator Nelson Aldrich, the father-in-law of billionaire heir to the Rockefeller dynasty, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. A central figure on the influential Senate Finance Committee, where he oversaw the nation's monetary policy, Aldrich was referred to in the press as the general manager of the nation. Joining him that evening was his private secretary, Shelton, and a who's who of the nation's banking and financial elite. A. Pyatt Andrew, the assistant treasury secretary, Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, Henry P. Davison, a senior partner of J.P. Morgan Company, Benjamin Strong Jr., an associate of J.P. Morgan and president of Bankers Trust Co., and Paul Warburg, heir of the Warburg banking family and son-in-law of Solomon Loeb of the famed New York investment firm Kuhn Loeb & Company. The men had been told to arrive one by one after sunset to attract as little attention as possible. Indeed, secrecy was so important to their mission that the group did not use anything but their first names throughout the journey so as to keep their true identity secret even from their own servants and waitstaff. The movements of any one of them would have been reason enough to attract the attention of New York's voracious press, especially in an era where banking and monetary reform was seen as a key issue for the future of the nation. A meeting of all of them, now that would surely have been the story of the century. And it was. Their destination? The secluded Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia, home to the prestigious Jekyll Island Club, whose members included the Morgans, Rockefellers, Warburgs, and Rothschilds. Their purpose? Davison told intrepid local reporters who had caught wind of the meeting that they were going duck hunting. But in reality, they were going to draft a reform of the nation's banking industry in complete secrecy. G. Edward Griffin, the author of the best-selling The Creature from Jekyll Island and a longtime Federal Reserve researcher, explains.
What happened is that the banks decided that since there was going to be legislation anyway to control their industry, that they wouldn't just sit back and wait and see what happened and cross their fingers that it would be okay. They decided that to do what so many cartels do today, they decided to take the lead. And they would be the ones calling for regulations and reform. They like the word reform. And the American people are suckers for the word reform. You just put that into any corrupt piece of legislation, call it reform, and people say, oh, I'm all for reform. And so they vote for it or accept it. So that's what they were doing. They decided we will reform our own industry. In other words, we will create a cartel. And we will give the cartel the power of government. We'll take our cartel agreement so that we can self-regulate to our advantage, and we'll call it the Federal Reserve Act. And then we'll take this cartel agreement to Washington and convince those idiots there to pass it into law. And that basically was the strategy. It was a brilliant strategy. Of course, we see it happening all the time, and certainly in our own day today, we see the same thing happening in other cartelized industry. Right now, we're watching it unfold in the field of healthcare, but at that time, it was banking. All right, and so the banking cartel wrote their own rules and regulations, called it the Federal Reserve Act, got it passed into law, and it was very much to their liking because they wrote it. And in essence, what they had created is a set of rules which made it possible for themselves to regulate their industry, but they went even beyond that. In fact, it's clear to me when I was reading their letters and their conversations at the time and the debates that they never dreamed that Congress would go along and also give them the right to issue the nation's money supply. I mean, not only were they now going to regulate their own industry, which is what they started out as wanting to do, but they got this incredible gift that they didn't dream would be given to them, although they were negotiating for it. And that was Congress gave them the authority to issue the nation's money. And Congress gave away the sovereign right to issue the nation's money to the private banks. And so all of this was in the Federal Reserve Act, and the American people were joyous because they were told and they were convinced that this was finally a means of controlling this big creature from Jekyll Island.
Amazingly enough, they were successful, not just in conspiring to write the legislation that would eventually become the Federal Reserve Act, but in keeping that conspiracy a secret from the public for decades. It was first reported on in 1916 by Bertie Charles Forbes, the financial writer who would later go on to found Forbes magazine, but it was never fully admitted until a quarter century later when Frank Vanderlip wrote a casual admission of the meeting in the February 9, 1935 edition of the Saturday Evening Post. I was as secretive, indeed as furtive, as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. Over the course of their 9 days of deliberation at the Jekyll Island Club, they devised a plan so overarching, so ambitious, that even they could scarcely imagine that it would ever be passed by Congress. As Vanderlip put it, "Discovery of our plan, we knew, simply must not happen, or else all our time and effort would be wasted. If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had got together and written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatever of passage by Congress." So what precisely did this conclave of conspirators devise at their Jekyll Island meeting? A plan for a central banking system to be owned by the banks themselves, a system which would organize the nation's banks into a private cartel that would have sole control over the money supply itself. At the end of their 9-day meeting, the bankers and financiers went back to their respective offices content in what they had accomplished. The details of the plan changed between its 1910 drafting and the eventual passage of the Federal Reserve Act, but the essential ideas were there. But ultimately, this scene on Jekyll Island, too, is just one piece of a larger puzzle. And like any other puzzle piece, it has to be seen in its wider context for the bigger picture to become visible. To understand the other pieces of the puzzle and their importance in the creation of the Federal Reserve, we have to travel backward in time. The story begins in late 17th century Europe. The 9 Years' War is raging across the continent as Louis XIV of France finds himself pitted against much of the rest of the continent over his territorial and dynastic claims. King William III of England, devastated by a stunning naval defeat, commits his court to rebuilding the English navy. There's only one problem: money. The government's coffers have been exhausted by the waging of the war, and William's credit is drying up. A Scottish banker, William Paterson, has a banker's solution. A proposal to form a company to lend £1 million to the government at 6% plus 5,000 management fee, with the right of note issue. By 1694, the idea has been slightly revised: a £1.2 million loan at 8% plus 4,000 for management expenses. But it goes ahead. The magnanimously titled Bank of England is created. The name is a carefully constructed lie, designed to make the bank appear to be a government entity. But it is not. It is a private bank owned by private shareholders for their private profit, with a charter from the king that allows them to print the public's money out of thin air and lend it to the crown. What happens here at the birth of the Bank of England in 1694 is the creation of a template that will be repeated in country after country around the world: a privately controlled central bank lending money to the government at interest, money that it prints out of nothing. And the jewel in the crown for the international bankers that creates this system is the future economic powerhouse of the world, the United States. In many important respects, the history of the United States is the history of the struggle of the American people against the banksters that wish to control their money. By the 1780s, with colonies still fighting for independence from the crown, the bankers will get their wish. In 1781, the United States is in financial turmoil. The Continental, the paper currency issued by the Continental Congress to pay for the war, has collapsed from overissue and British counterfeiting. Desperate to find a way to finance the end stages of the war, Congress turns to Robert Morris, a wealthy shipping merchant who was investigated for war profiteering just 2 years earlier. Now, as Superintendent of Finance of the United States from 1781 to 1784, he is regarded as the most powerful man in America, next to General Washington. In his capacity as Superintendent of Finance, Morris argues for the creation of a privately owned central bank, deliberately modeled on the Bank of England that the colonies were supposedly fighting against. Congress, backed into a corner by war obligations and forced to do business with the bankers just like King William in the 1690s, acquiesces and charters the Bank of North America as the nation's first central bank. And exactly as the Bank of England came into existence loaning the British Crown £1.2 million, the BNA started business by loaning $1.2 million to Congress. By the end of the war, Morris has fallen out of political favor and the Bank of North America's currency has failed to win over a skeptical public. The BNA is downgraded from a national central bank to a private commercial bank chartered by the state of Pennsylvania. But the bankers have not given up yet. Before the ink is even dry on the Constitution, a group led by Alexander Hamilton is already working on the next privately owned central bank for the newly formed United States of America. So brazen is Hamilton in the forwarding of this agenda that he makes no attempt to hide his aims or those of the banking interests he serves. A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing, he wrote in a letter to James Duane in 1781. It will be a powerful cement of our union. It will also create a necessity for keeping up taxation to a degree which, without being oppressive, will be a spur to industry. Opposition to Hamilton and his debt-based system for establishing the finances of the U.S. is fierce. Led by Jefferson and Madison, the bankers and their system of debt enslavement is called out for the force of destruction that it is, with Thomas Jefferson writing, "The spirit of war and indictment, since the modern theory of the perpetuation of debt, has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating." Still, Hamilton proves victorious. The first Bank of the United States is chartered in 1791 and follows the pattern of the Bank of England and the Bank of North America almost exactly. A privately owned central bank with the authority to loan money that it creates out of nothing to the government. In fact, it is the very same people behind the new bank as were behind the old Bank of North America. It was Alexander Hamilton, Robert Morris's former aide, who first proposed Morris for the position of financial superintendent, and the director of the old Bank of North America, Thomas Willing, is brought in to serve as the first director of the first Bank of the United States. Meet the new banking bosses, same as the old banking bosses. In the first 5 years of the bank's existence, the U.S. government borrows $8.2 million from the bank, and prices rise 72%. By 1795, when Hamilton leaves office, the incoming Treasury Secretary announces that the government needs even more money and sells off the government's meager 20% share in the bank, making it a fully private corporation. Once again, the U.S. economy is plundered while the private banking cartel laughs all the way to the bank that they created. By the time the bank's charter comes due for renewal in 1811, the tide has changed for the money interests behind the bank. Hamilton is dead, shot to death in a duel with Aaron Burr. The bank-supporting Federalist Party is out of power. The public are wary of foreign ownership of the central bank, and what's more, don't see the point of a central bank in time of peace. Accordingly, the charter renewal is voted down in the Senate, and the bank is closed in 1811. Less than a year later, the U.S. is once again at war with England. After 2 years of bitter struggle, the public debt of the U.S. has nearly tripled from $45.2 million to $119.2 million. With trade at a standstill, prices soaring, inflation rising, and debt mounting, President Madison signs the charter for the creation of another central bank, the Second Bank of the United States, in 1816. Just like the two central banks before it, it is majority privately owned and is granted the power to loan money that it creates out of thin air to the government. The 20-year bank charter is due to expire in 1836, but still in his first term, President Andrew Jackson has already vowed to let it die prior to renewal. Believing that Jackson won't risk his chance for re-election in 1832 on the issue, the bankers forward a bill to renew the bank's charter in July of that year, 4 years ahead of schedule. Remarkably, Jackson vetoes the renewal charter and stakes his re-election on the people's support of his move. In his veto message, Jackson writes in no uncertain terms about his opposition to the bank. Whatever interest or influence, whether public or private, has given birth to this act, it cannot be found either in the wishes or necessities of the executive department, by which present action is deemed premature, and the powers conferred upon its agent not only unnecessary, but dangerous to the government and country. It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes. If we cannot at once, in justice to interests vested under improvident legislation, make our government what it ought to be, we can at least take a stand against all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many, and in favor of compromise and gradual reform in our code of laws and system of political economy. The people side with Jackson, and he's re-elected on the back of his slogan, Jackson and No Bank. The president makes good on his pledge. In 1833, he announces that the government will stop using the bank and will pay off its debt. The bankers retaliate in 1834 by staging a financial crisis and attempting to pin the blame on Jackson, but it's no use. On January 8, 1835, President Jackson succeeds in paying off the debt, and for the first and only time in its history, the United States is free from the debt chain of the bankers. In 1836, the Second Bank of the United States charter expires, and the bank loses its status as America's central bank. It is 77 years before the bankers can regain the jewel in their crown, but it is not for lack of trying. Immediately upon the death of the bank, the banking oligarchs in England react by contracting trade, removing capital from the U.S., demanding payment in hard currency for all exports, and tightening credit. This results in a financial crisis known as the Panic of 1837, and once again Jackson's campaign to kill the bank is blamed for the crisis. Throughout the late 19th century, the United States is rocked by banking panics brought about by wild banking speculation and sharp contractions in credit. By the dawn of the 20th century, the bulk of the money in the American economy has been centralized in the hands of a small clique of industrial magnates, each with a near monopoly on a sector of the economy. There are the Astors in real estate, the Carnegies and the Schwabs in steel, the Harrimans, Stanfords, and Vanderbilts in railroads, the Mellons and the Rockefellers in oil. As all of these families start to consolidate their fortunes, they gravitate naturally to the banking sector. And in this capacity, they form a network of financial interests and institutions that centered largely around one man, banking scion and increasingly America's informal central banker in the absence of a central bank, John Pierpont Morgan. John Pierpont Morgan, or Pierpont as he prefers to be called, is born in Hartford, Connecticut in 1837 to Junius Spencer Morgan, a successful banker and financier. Morgan rides his father's coattails into the banking business, and by 1871 is partnered in his own firm, the firm that was eventually to become J.P. Morgan & Company. It is Morgan who finances Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad. It is Morgan that finances the launch of nearly every major corporation of the period, from AT&T to General Electric to General Motors to DuPont. It is Morgan who buys out Carnegie and creates the United States Steel Corporation, America's first billion-dollar company. It is Morgan who brokers a deal with President Grover Cleveland to save the nation's gold reserves by selling $62 million worth of gold to the Treasury in return for government bonds. And it is Morgan who, in 1907, sets in motion the crisis that leads to the creation of the Federal Reserve. That year, Morgan begins spreading rumors about the precarious finances of the Knickerbocker Trust Company, a Morgan competitor and one of the largest financial institutions in the United States at the time. The resulting crisis, dubbed the Panic of 1907, shakes the U.S. financial system to its core. Morgan puts himself forward as a hero, boldly offering to help underwrite some of the faltering banks and brokerage houses to keep them from going under. After a bout of hand-wringing over the nation's finances, a congressional committee is assembled to investigate the Money Trust, the bankers and financiers who brought the nation so close to financial ruin and that wield such power over the nation's finances. The public follows the issue closely, and in the end a handful of bankers are identified as key players in the Money Trust's operations, including Paul Warburg, Benjamin Strong Jr., and J.P. Morgan. Andrew Gavin Marshall, editor of the People's Book Project, explains.
At the beginning of the 20th century, there was an investigation following the greatest of these financial panics, which was in 1907. And this investigation was on what was called the Money Trust, which found that three banking interests, J.P. Morgan, National City Bank, and the City Bank of New York, I believe it was, basically controlled the entire financial system. So three banks. And the public hatred towards these institutions was unprecedented. There was an overwhelming consensus in the country for establishing a central bank. But there were many different interests in pushing this, and everyone had sort of their own specific purpose behind advocating for a central bank. So to represent the most people, you had farmer interests, populists, progressives, who were advocating a central bank because they couldn't take the recurring panics, but they wanted government control of a central bank. They wanted it to be exclusively under the public control because they despised and feared the New York banks as wielding too much influence. So for them, a central bank would be a way to curb the power of these private financial interests. On the other hand, those same financial interests were advocating for a central bank to serve as a source of stability for their control of the system, also to act as a lender of last resort to them, and so that they would never have to face a collapse, but also in order to exert more control through a central bank. The private New York banking community wanted a central bank under the exclusive control of them. There's a shocker. So you had all these various different interests which converge. Of course, the most influential happened to be the New York financial houses, which were more aligned with European financial houses than they were with any other element in American society. The main individual behind the founding of the Federal Reserve was Paul Warburg, who was a partner with Kuhn Loeb and Company, European banking house. His brothers were prominent bankers in Germany at that time, and he had, of course, close connections with every major financial and really big industrial firm in the United States and most of those existing in Europe. And he was discussing all these ideas with his fellow compatriots in advocating for a central bank. In 1910, Warburg got the support of a senator named Senator Aldrich, whose family later married into the Rockefeller family. Again, I'm sure just a coincidence, but Aldrich invited Warburg and a number of other bankers to a private secret meeting on Jekyll Island, just off the coast of Georgia, where they met in 1910. To discuss the construction of a central bank in the United States, but one which, of course, would be owned and serve the interests of the private bankers. Aldrich then, in 1911, presented this as the Aldrich Plan or the Aldrich Bill in the U.S. Congress, and it was actually voted out.
The public, suspicious of Senator Aldrich's banking connections, ultimately reject the Jekyll Island Cabal's Aldrich Plan. The Cabal does not give up, however. They simply revise and rename their plan, giving it a new public face, that of Senator Robert Owen and Representative Carter Glass. In the end, the money trust that was behind the Panic of 1907 uses the public's own outrage against them to complete their consolidation of control over the banking system. The newly retitled Federal Reserve Act is signed into law on December 23, 1913, and the Fed begins operations the next year. So how does the Federal Reserve System work? What does it do? Who owns and controls it?
You are tuned in to the Black Talk
Radio. These are the basic questions that would get to the heart of the fundamental question, what is money? And that is why the answer to these questions have been shrouded in impenetrable economic jargon.
For live programming schedules.
Even the Federal Reserve's...
Did you want me to stop it there? Hello? Okay, so I will continue.
Own educational propaganda, which has an unusual tendency towards cutesy animation and talking
Sorry.
Down to its audience,
Sorry, Scotty.
Has
yeah,
a difficult
you can stop
time summarizing the Fed's...
Okay, everyone, we're going to go to a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll definitely talk about what it is. Very, very important stuff. Got caught and I was trying to unmute myself. So you listen to Tango Radio Show, brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break.
Programming schedules, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. The Tando Radio Show is live on Black Talk Radio Network, Monday through Fridays at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Check Black Talk Radio Network on Facebook for updates. Also, don't forget to follow Tando Radio Show on Facebook as well. Have a question or comment for the host? Give us a call at 641-715-3660. That's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. That's 549-032-POUND. To signal the host, hit *61. Now back to Tando Radio Show on the Black Talk Radio Network.
Okay, welcome back, everyone, to Tando Radio Show, brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, David Wren, a.k.a. Dave from L.A., and that was a great we're going to play the rest of it a little bit later. Not today, but at another time. And very enlightening. It was a lot of things. There are some things I don't agree with. I look at things very, very differently than a lot of people. But there was some, the foundation of it was very great. The historical portion of it that was really good. One thing is that we really need to talk about and understand is that what a lot of people call money, which was even displayed here in this video, is not money. A lot of people do not understand what real money is. And, you know, that is probably one of the biggest traps and the biggest obstacles that we have when it comes to the economics and understanding it, because we are not taught what true money is. And that is so important that we understand those things, because that's the essence of everything. So when they talk about, no, money doesn't grow on trees, but what they consider money is not money at all. And it's so important. But, and also, you know, this is why we give the membership class and we teach you all of those things, because these things are things that you definitely, definitely need to know. And for the people that have taken the classes that I've done, they see it right away and they say, oh, snap, I had no clue, but it all makes sense. So another things is, this is a great, great video, and I'll post it inside of Tando. And I want a big shout out to my man, Russell, for sending me this. Russell G, my man. And it's important that we talk about this from the standpoint, because this is not a conspiracy theory. This is the conspirators. And this has been done for a long, long time. But even when they were talking about back in the revolutionary days and everything else, that is just a very small part of what really happened. And it's so important for us to understand history from a more truthful standpoint in order for you to understand just how thick and how deep this conspiracy is. Because they don't want you to know and peel back the onions of layers of the onion to it. Because then you would totally understand and they would cry because you would no longer participate in it. So one of the things that we have to understand with the banking institutions is that they actually write the overall laws that go into effect, from Glass-Steagall to the Dodd-Frank to the Volcker Rule to everything that comes out from the Federal Reserve Act to everything that was talked about there, and those things of which we weren't talked about, which they didn't talk about Glass-Steagall, but they mentioned glass in it. All of this stuff was written purposely by these institutions for the effect and for the moment in time that they wanted it to be in place. And they're going to continue to write the destruction of your economic foundation as long as you and I allow them to. And that is what has to change. This is why you hear a lot of bankers talk about different things. I'm going to tell you something right off the bat. Every banker hates gold. Yeah, because that's their schooling. They don't understand, it, and they don't understand a lot of the fundamental, because they want to be able to do what? Control your ability to function in an economy. And that's so, so important. And we got Brother Braggs on. I want to hear his, you know, what he has to say about it all. And then we're going to talk about capital controls and why this is so important for you all, so that you can start to get a more concise picture. No, I don't know everything, but what I do know, I want to impart with you so it will help you. Okay? Then there's things that there's an act of furtherance that has to go beyond what we talk about here, where you're going to have to carry this, because I'm going to tell you, we so blindly give our overall economic future to people that we don't even know. I always say to people, why are you giving, do you know your banker? Do you know the CEO of the bank that you bank at? Do you know the franchise owner of the bank you work at? I mean, excuse me, that you deposit at. Do you know the hedge fund manager or the fund manager for the 401k plan or retirement plan that your retirement is based in? Your whole lifelong working history is being stored there, and you don't know that person's name. You don't know the person's character. You don't know their drinking habits, their drug habits, their gambling habits. You don't know their marital status, how much alimony they pay, or anything about them. But what you do is you blindly go to them and you give them your lifelong savings and expect them to do you right. When they look at you as this, they look at you like a lot of people today as with a sense of entitlement. They believe that they're entitled to what you've worked so hard for them to do what they want to do so that they will gain and not you. They never break it to you that way, but that is the truth. I ask any of you, do you know the person that is running your 401k? Do you really know them? You know their criminal history, their drug habit, their alcohol, their drinking habits? Do you know anything about them? Can you call them on the phone? Do you know their moral convictions and their moral character? No, 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 no. But still, the system tells you to give one something that's so valuable and so important to you, just give it to them blindly. The only person that should be in charge of your economic future and your economic direction is you. This is why this stuff is so boring to so many people, because they want people to be bored so that they'll do what? To say, oh, it's too hard, let me just give it to them. They want the foolish of thoughts and the gullible of hearts. And at some time, you have to walk away from being that way, because it's been taught to you that way by every institution except here at Black Talk Radio Network and at Tando. If you know your drinking habits, your drug habits, your criminal history, your moral convictions, then why the heck aren't you dictating your economic future? Why aren't you in control of it? You don't trust you? Well, then learn some discipline and step out on your own sovereign pattern, in your own set your own sovereign journey. It's yours, it's not theirs, but it becomes theirs once you surrender it. This is why I teach what we teach in our membership, so that you could do this for yourself, your family, and teach our young people to be sovereign and self-determining. You're not selfish. So many of us talk about wanting to be free, but we don't have the discipline to walk the path of freedom. But what it is that we want to do is really this: just make me as comfortable, as pleasing to me as possible, and I'm cool. Well, every domesticated animal or person, once they're broken, they're content with comfort. Just make them comfortable. There's nothing comfortable about life. It's work that needs to be done, and it's a journey of growth. It's hard to grow when you're comfortable. Virtually impossible. So let's go to my man, brother Bragg.
Hey, peace.
Peace, bro. I just want to say, man, great picture of just one corner of the archives that Brother Bragg. But Brother Bragg, I know that you read and we talked about it, this banking cabal and this banking entity, man. That's really, really...
Let me run three things to you right quick. As you were speaking, I was looking over this stuff right quick. So I'm going to run with it right quick. Check this out. I was just checking this... Civil law, equity law is the law of the ruler. Common law is the law of the people. I heard you mention that before. No one is bound to obey unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce unconstitutional law. The Constitution guarantees the right of a freeholder to protect his property from criminal trespass. That goes for your body, too. Now, back to the Abe Lincoln. Let me show you how deep these words were. 1 month after the inauguration of President Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States, from 1860 until his assassination, 1865, the American Civil War gets underway at Fort Sumter, South Carolina. The real reason for the war is that the southern states were in dire economic situation due to the actions of the northern states. Northern industrials had used trade tariffs to prevent the southern states from buying cheaper European goods. Now, this all goes with the Federal Reserve, just so you put it in context. Europe subsequently retaliated by stopping cotton imports from the South. Thus, the South had been forced to pay more for goods while having their income slashed. This is when the money changes saw the opportunity to divide and conquer America by plunging it into civil war. This is confirmed by Otto von Bismarck when he was Chancellor of Germany, 1871-1890, who stated the following in 1876. The division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained as one bloc and as one nation, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over the world. The voice of Rothschilds predominated. They foresaw the tremendous booty if they could substitute feeble democracies indebted to the finances for the vigorous republic. Confident and self-providing, therefore, they started their emissaries in order to exploit the question of slavery and thus dig in an abyss between the two parts of the republic. Indeed, only months after these first shots in the South Carolina, the Rothschilds loaned Napoleon III of France, the Napoleon of the Battle of Waterloo's nephew, 210 million francs to seize Mexico and then station troops along the southern border of the United States, taking advantage of the American Civil War to return Mexico to colonial rule. This was a violation of the Monroe Doctrine, which was issued by President James Monroe during the 7th Annual State of the Union Address to Congress in 1823. This doctrine proclaimed the United States' opinion that European powers should no longer colonize the Americas or interfere with the affairs of foreign of sovereign nations located in America, such as the United States, Mexico, and others. In return, the United States planned to stay neutral in the war between European powers and the wars between Europe. However, these latter type of wars were to occur in the Americas. The United States view such action as hostile towards itself. While the French were breaching the Monroe Doctrine in Mexico, the British followed suit by moving 11,000 troops into Canada, positioning them along North America's northern border. President Lincoln knew he was in trouble. So he went to his secretary. Now this is where they get to this money. Solomon P. Chase to New York to supply for the loans necessary to fund America's defense. The Rothschilds had engineered the war to make the Union fail and were not about to save it now. So they instructed their American banks to offer loans at 24% to 36% interest. President Lincoln declined. This as they knew he would and return to Washington, where he sent for Colonel Dick Taylor of Chicago, who he put in charge of the problem of how he should finance the war. During one meeting, President Lincoln asked Colonel Taylor what proposals he had come up with to finance the war. And this is what he stated. Why, Lincoln? That is easy. Just get Congress to pass a bill authorizing the printing of full legal tender treasury notes and pay your soldiers with them and go ahead and win your war with them also. President Lincoln asked Colonel Taylor if the people of the United States would accept the notes, to which Colonel Taylor replied, if people or anyone else will not have any choice in the matter. If you make them full legal tender, they will have the full sanction of the government and be just as good as any money. Congress is given an express right by the Constitution. And then it goes, President Lincoln began printing 450 million worth of American currency. These bills are printed in green ink and on the reverse side in order to distinguish them from other bills in circulation. They're called greenbacks. These are printed at no interest to the federal government and are used to pay the troops and purchase their supplies. President Lincoln would be the last president to issue debt-free United States notes on this subject. He states, a government should create, issue, and circulate all money and credit needed to satisfy the spending power of the government and the buying power of consumers. The privilege of creating and issuing money is not only the supreme prerogative of the government, it is the government's greatest creative opportunity. By the adoption of these principles, the taxpayers will save immense sums of interest. Money will cease to be master and become the servant of humanity. He also states, we gave the people of this republic the greatest blessing they ever had by owning their own money to pay their own debts, by owning their own money to pay their own debts. The same year, the Times of London illustrates who's pulling the strings. When it published the story containing the following statement, if the mischievous financial policy, which had its origin in the North American Republic, should become indurated down to a fixture, then the government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debt, and without a debt, it will have all the money necessary to carry on the commerce. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in the history of civilized government of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. The government must be destroyed, or will destroy every monarchy on the globe. Now check it out. They're destroying them. They need to destroy them because if they're independent, they can't control them. They can't run their money.
Right. Right. And
okay,
you know,
have this. Go ahead, Dave.
And you know, this is so important that we understand the history of the whole thing. You know, Brother Braggs had talked about, and we talked about this individual before on here on Tando. He said Salmon P. Chase. This is the same Chase that Chase Bank is named after. And the reason why they named this bank after him is because of what he did was that he enslaved this whole country to paper debt, to paper currency. And how he did it was a genius plan. And one of the things about Salmon P. Chase was this. He was known as an abolitionist, but see, he really wasn't, but that was the disguise. They all come in the disguise. They try to create a crisis and try to provide the solution. What they were really doing was trying to enslave every single person here, and they were going to do it through currency, and that's exactly what they did. And he did it so well that he was the first one to put he was the one, and the reason why Chase Bank had, he was the first to institute the IRS, and he was the first to establish basically the Federal Reserve System. And because of, he was so intertwined in such a key figure in establishing cash debt enslavement, Chase Bank named their whole organization after him. And these are the things that we really need to know and put this together so that we can see that there is no such thing as a conspiracy theory. It's just the conspiracy and the conspirators. And their target is always you. So,
yeah. Hey, one more thing, Dan, before you go any further. Let me just finish that paragraph.
Yeah, go ahead.
A hazard circuit from Rothschild, controlled Bank of England, comes to light some years later. That provides further information as to why Lincoln's debt-free money, the greenback, had to be stopped. Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power, and the chattel slavery destroyed. This I and my Jewish European friends are glad of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers, while the European plan led by England is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see is to be made out of the war. Must be used as a means to control the volume of money. To accomplish this, the bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now awaiting the Secretary of the Treasury to make the recommendation to Congress. It will not do to allow the greenback, as it is called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that. President Lincoln discovers that the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, 1855-1881, had been having problems with the Rothschilds as well, and he had been refusing their continual attempts to set up a central bank in Russia. The Tsar then gives President Lincoln some unexpected help. The Tsar issues orders that if either England or France actively intervene in the American Civil War and help the South, Russia will consider such an action a declaration of war and take the side of President Lincoln. To show that he wasn't messing around, he sends part of his Pacific fleet to Port of San Francisco, and another part to the Port of New York. The Rothschild Banking House in Naples, Italy, CMB, the Rothschild E. Fligge, closes following the unification of Italy. The Rothschilds used one of their own in America, John D. Rockefeller, to form an oil business called Standard Oil, which eventually takes over all of this competition. 1864, president is reelected on November 8th and November 21st, as he writes a friend of the following: the money power is praised upon the nation. In times of peace, it conspires against it. In times of adversity, it is more despotic than monarchy, and more insolent than autocracy, and more selfish than bureaucracy. Rothschild agent August Belmont, who by now is the Democratic Party's national chairman, 1860-1872, supports General George McClinton as the Democratic nominee to run against President Abraham Lincoln in this year's election. Much of the anger of Belmont, President Lincoln wins the election. In a statement to Congress, President Abraham Lincoln states, 1865, I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in the front of me and the financial institutions in the rear. Of the two, the one in my rear is the greatest foe, the bankers. On April 14, 41 days after his second inauguration, just 5 days after General Lee surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox, President Lincoln is shot by John Wilkes Booth at Forest Theater. He would die of his injuries less than 2 months before the end of the American Civil War. More than 70 years later, Booth's granddaughter, Isaiah Forrester, reveals in her book on Booth this one mad act that he had been put up to, this assassination by powerful interests in Europe. And contrary to reports that Booth was later killed by American authorities, he actually escaped to Europe and died in Chalice at the age of 39. Subsequent allegations that international banks were responsible for President Lincoln's assassination will be made in the Canadian House of Commons nearly 7 years later. In 1934, the person who revealed this was Canadian attorney Gerald G. McGeer. He was obtained evidence deleted from the public record provided to him by a Secret Service agent at the trial of John Wilkes Booth. After Booth's alleged death, McGeer stated that it showed that John Wilkes Booth was a mercenary working for the international bankers. His speech was reported in an article in the Vancouver Sun, dated 2nd May, 1934, which stated, Abraham Lincoln, the murdered emancipator of the slaves, was assassinated through the mechanism of a group of representative international bankers who feared the United States president's national credit ambitions. There were only one group in the world at that time who had any reason to desire the death of Lincoln. There were the men opposed to the national currency program who had fought for him throughout the whole Civil War on his policy of greenback currency. Gerald G. McGeer, who stated that Lincoln's assassination was not purely because of international bankers wanted to reestablish a central bank in America, but also because they wanted to base America's currency on gold, which they, of course, controlled. They wanted to put America on a gold standard. This was in direct opposition to President Lincoln's policy of issuing greenbacks based solely on the good faith and credit of the United States. The Vancouver Sun article also quoted Gerald G. McGeer the following statement. They were the men...
Hold on right there, Brother Brad. Okay. Hold on right there. Okay. Hold on right there. We're going to go to a commercial break. When we come back, we're going to break this down for you and tell you why this is so important. There was a lot of things that Brother Rags had broke there, and we're going to put it all in synthesizers for you so that you can see that you are putting yourself in harm's way. You're listening to Tando Radio Show, brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back after this quick commercial. These quick commercial breaks.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
You are tuned in to the Tando Radio Show on Black Talk Radio Network. Have a question or comment? Give us a call at 641-715-3660. That's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND, 549-032-POUND. To signal the host, hit *61. Now back to Dave and the Tando Radio Show.
All right, welcome back, everyone. The Tando Radio Show, brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, David Wren, a.k.a. Dave from L.A., and on the show today with us, we have Brother Braggs, and we just want to thank you all for listening. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, if you have any comments or questions, definitely give us a call, 641-715-3660, and the participant code is 549032#, and then hit star 61. So how many of you knew of all of this history there? Because this isn't something that is purposely taught throughout history, because they don't want you to know these things. But it's right there in front of you if you just go and look, so that you can start to realize something, that you need to be self-determining in your overall life, economically, also as far as your whole course and your journey of life needs to be governed and mandated by you. So we were just, Brother Braggs was breaking down some things on what was going on, and I hope you caught something. Now you can see why there's always been a disdain between Russia and what's going on to this day. This is why the Russians have always despised the Nazis, because everything we're talking about here, and Brother Bragg alluded to that, everything we talk about here is more based in, not in cash, but in a demonic ritual. These demonic rituals of control. So I don't want to give too much away. We'll definitely talk about those things.
But just remember the Tsar of Russia, what he just did. He just made powerful enemies when he backed America, when he backed Lincoln on that. He made enemies for that's going to make him pay down the road.
Yep, that whole family is going to pay, and you're going
that's
to
right.
see it. And you're going to see how that plays out, and it continues to play out to this day. So, but go ahead, Brother Rack.
All right. Well, I was on Lincoln, right? I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in front of me and the financial institutions in the rear. But I want to skip ahead just a little bit.
Yeah.
Abraham Lincoln, the murdered, emancipated, enslaved, and assassinated through the machinations of a group of international bankers who feared the United States and the president's national credit ambitions. We're going to get up to this. The Vancouver Sun arc also quoted Gerald G. McGeer with the following statement. They were the men interested in establishing the gold standard, the right of the bankers to manage the currency and credit of every nation in the world. With Lincoln out of the way, they were able to proceed with their plan, and did proceed with it in the United States. Within 8 years after Lincoln's assassination, silver was demonetized and gold standard system set up in the United States. Interestingly, there has been much speculation that Abraham Lincoln was actually the illegitimate son of an A. Springs pre-cyclo Jew named Springsteen, a Rothschild. Following a brief training period in the Rothschild's London bank, Jacob Schniff, a Rothschild born in their house in Frankfurt, arrives in America at the age of 18 with instructions and the finance necessary to buy into the banking house there. The purpose of this is to carry out the following tasks: gain control of America's money system through the establishment of a central bank, find desirable men who, for the price, are willing to serve as stooges for the Illuminati, and promote them into high places in the federal government, Congress, the Supreme Court, and all federal agencies. Create minority group strife throughout the nations, particularly targeting the whites and the blacks. Create a movement to destroy the religion in the United States with Christianity as the main problem. Nathaniel D. Rothschild becomes member of the parliament for Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. 1918, 66, 10 years Rothschild died. 1868, on November 15, Jacob James Meyer Rothschild dies. Shortly after purchasing Chateau Latif, one of the four great premier grand estates of France, he is the last Meyer Amschel Rothschild son to die. 1869, at the funeral of Grand Rabbi, thanks to the terrible power of our international bank, we have forced the Christians into wars without number. Wars have a special value for Jews, since Christians massacre each other and make room for us. Jews. Wars are the Jews' harvest. The Jews' banks grow fat on Christian wars. Over 100 million Christians have been swept off the face of the earth by wars, and the end is not yet. On March 16, Barbette Rothschild died. 1870, Nathaniel D. Rothschild died. 1871, American general named Albert Pike, who had been enticed into the Illuminati by Giuseppe Mazzelli, completes his military blueprint for three world wars and various revolutions throughout the world, cumulating into moving this great conspiracy into its final stage. These details are as follows. The First World War is to be fought for the purpose of destroying the Tsar in Russia, as promised by Nathan Meyer and Rothschild in 1850. The Tsar is to be replaced by
with communism, which is to be used to attack religions, predominantly Christianity. The difference between British and German empires are to be used to foment this, the Second World War, is to be used to foment the controversy between fascism and political Zionism and the oppression of Jews in Germany, a lynchpin, and bringing hatred against the German people. This is designed to destroy fascism, which the Rothschilds created, and to increase the power of political Zionism. This war is also designed to increase the power of communism to the level that it equals that of United Christendom. The Third World War is to be played out by stirring up the hatred of the Muslim world for the purposes of playing the Islamic world and the political Zionists off one another. While this is going on, the remaining nations will be forced to fight themselves into a state of mental, physical, spiritual, and economic exhaustion. On the 15th of that year, Albert Pike writes a letter now cataloged in the British Museum to his deputy Mazzini, in which he states the following: "We shall unleash the nihilist and the atheist, and we shall provoke a great social catechism, which in all its horrors will show clearly to all nations the effect of absolute atheism, the origins of savagery, and of most bloody turmoil, that everywhere the people will be forced to defend themselves against the world minority of the world revolutionaries, and will exterminate those destroyers of civilization and the multitude disillusioned with Christianity, whose spirits will be from the moment without direction and leadership, and anxious for an ideal, but without knowledge, where it sends its adoration to receive the true light, the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer, brought finally out into the public view, a manifestation which will result from general reactionary movement, which will follow the destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." Pike, who had been elected to Sovereign Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite of Freemason Southern Jurisdiction in 1859, the most powerful Freemason in America, he would retain the post for 32 years until his death in 1891. He published a book on this subject in 1872 entitled Morals and Dogma of Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite Freemasonry, in which he candidly states the following: "The true name of Satan, the Kabbalists say, is that of Yahweh reversed. For Satan is not a black god, but a negation of God. For the initiates, this is not a person, but a force greater for good, with which they may serve for evil. It is the instrument of liberty and will. Lucifer, the light bearer, strange and mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness. Lucifer, the son of morning, it is he who bears the light. With his splendor's intolerable, blind, feeble, sensual, selfish soul, doubt it not." Interestingly, in the same book, Pike emphasized that Freemasonry is a religion based on occult Jewish philosophy found in Kabbalah. 1872, Giuseppe Mazzini, death this year, that makes another revolutionary leader named Adrian Lemmy his successor. Lemmy was subsequently succeeded by Lenin and Trotsky, then by Stalin. The revolutionary activities of all these men are financed by the Rothschilds. 1873, Tino copper mines in Spain are purchased by a group of foreign financiers, including the Rothschilds. These mines are Europe's largest source of copper. 1875, January 1st, Jacob Sniff, now Solomon Loeb's son-in-law, after marrying his daughter Teresa, takes control of banking house of Kern, Loeb and Company. Schiff goes to finance the Standard Oil Company of crypto genie John D. Rockefeller. He also finds Edward R. Harriman Railroad Empire, Andrew Carnegie Steel Empire. This is all the Rothschild money. He then identifies the other largest bankers in America at that time. They are J.P. Morgan, who controls Wall Street, and the Jetsons, the Biddies of Philadelphia, the Bills of Philadelphia, all of the other financiers, large and small, would dance to the tune of those three houses. Sniff then gets the European Rothschilds to set up European branches. These three large banks are understanding that Sniff, and therefore Rothschild, is to be the boss banking in New York, and therefore America. Any Rothschild and Sons undertake a share issue. A share issue to raise capital for the first chattel tunnel project to link France to England. With this half of this capital coming from the Rothschild-owned Campagne du Chemin du Fer du Nord, that's French, I'm not good at that, and the Rothschilds need to control the Suez Canal to protect their huge business interests in the region. So Lionel D. Rothschild instructs U.S. Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli to purchase the shares in the Suez Canal from Khedive set of Egypt. The Rothschild loaned the money to the British government to facilitate the purchase. They did not want to own it themselves, as they needed a government that controlled to own it, so that they could use the military of that government to protect it. 1878, Archibald Philip Primrose, the fifth Earl of Rosebery, who would go to the British Prime Minister in 1894, marries Hannah D. Rothschild, the daughter of Byron Meyer D. Rothschild. The marriage produces four children: Harry Primrose, Lord Delamy, later 16th Earl of Rosebery, Honorable Neil Primrose, Lady Sybil Primrose, and Lady Margaret Primrose. 1879, Lionel D. Rothschild dies. Rothschild then began forming a series of programs, predominantly in Russia, but also in Poland, Bulgaria, and Romania. D. These programs resulted in the slaughter of thousands of Jews, causing approximately 2 million to flee, mainly to New York, but also to Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Los Angeles. However, some are assisted with Rothschild money to begin settling Palestine. The reason these programs were initiated was to create a large Jewish base in America, who, when they arrived, would be educated to register as Democrat voters. Some 20 years later, this would result in a massive Democratic power base in the United States and be used to elect Rothschild frontmen such as Woodrow Wilson to the presidency to carry out the bidding of the Rothschilds. In America, John Swinson, then preeminent in the New York Journal, was the greatest guest of honor at a banquet given him by leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor Swinson offered the toast to an independent press. Swinson outraged his colleagues by replying, "There's no such thing at this date of the world's history in America as independent press. You know it, and I know it. This is not one of you who dares to write your honest opinion, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper. I am connected with others of you who are paid similar salary for similar things, and you who would be so foolish to ask to write honest opinions would be out of streets looking for another job if I allowed my honest opinion to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to divert, to vilify, to fly at the feet of the mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it, and what a folly it is toasting an independent press. We are tools and vessels of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, our lives are all property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes." All right, man. And then you got President James A. Garfield, 20th president of the United States, who lasted only 100 days, 100 days, states, 2 weeks before his assassination. "Whoever controls the volume of money in our countries is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled, one way or another, by a very few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate. On March 13th, the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, was assassinated in St. Petersburg following several assassination attempts that began in 1866. Less than a year after President Lincoln's victory in the American Civil War, Edmund James D. Rothschild has a son, Maurice D. Rothschild, 1863, after 6,000 feet of tunnel in the Channel Tunnel Project has been excavated. The British government halted the project, citing the fact that it would be a threat to Britain's security. May 1885, Nathaniel Rothschild, son of Lionel D. Rothschild, becomes the first Jewish peer and takes the title of Lord Rothschild. 1886, the French Rothschild Bank, Rothschild Therese, obtained substantial amounts of Rothschild oil fields and forms the Caspian and Black Sea Petroleum Company, which quickly becomes the second largest oil producer. 1887, Edward Albert Sassoon, grandson of Rothschild opium monopolist David Sassoon, married Adeline Caroline D. Rothschild, the granddaughter of Jacob James Meyer Rothschild. That means Caroline's father, Gustave, together with his brother Alphonse, took over the Rothschild French farm. Following their father's death, the Rothschilds financed the amalgamation of Kimberley Diamond Mines in South Africa. They subsequently become the shareholders of this company. The beers and mine precious stones in Africa. Did you hear that? The Rothschilds financed the amalgamation of Kimberley Diamond Mines in South Africa. They subsequently become the biggest shareholders of this company. The beers and mine precious stones in Africa. 1888, Naomi Halpin, future wife of Maurice D. Rothschild, is born. The British Labour Party makes the... I'm sorry,
Hold on, Brother Braggs, real quick. Okay, anyway, if you have any questions or comments, definitely give us a call. Area code 641-715-3660, and the participant code is 549032 pound and hit star 61. I will see you in queue and bring you up. Now, let's talk about this real quick, Brother Braggs, because it was a lot of information that we need to synthesize for our listeners. This has been a long-standing conspiracy that is ongoing to this day. You heard of the different individuals and what they were doing, and those organizations are still in existence to this day. You know, you heard of Standard Oil. Where have you heard of Standard Oil from? The Standard Oil is nothing more than a front company for the Nazis that have actually been worked on by Prescott Bush and the Bush family completely, and all of the the covert actions that Standard Oil has been in. Then you heard of the Sassoons. Then you heard of the De Beers. And you heard all of this stuff comes into this from the standpoint of controlling humanity, which the De Beers are part of the Oppenheimer family. And the Oppenheimer family is the one that established what you know today as the Zionist state of Israel. That Star of David is after David Oppenheimer, not after David of the Bible. David of the Bible did not have a star. That was given to David Oppenheimer by the Swiss Germans who were fighting the Swiss at that time. And there was a reason why they were fighting the Swiss at that time, because it had everything to do with the controlling of the financial world and the markets in which and the overall rituals of demonic practices. This is why you see the Swiss Guard at the Vatican. They're not there to protect the Pope. They're there to protect the interests that they have within the overall sectors of the rituals and the sciences behind those rituals. So, man, Brother Bragg, so...
No, I want to take you sideways, Dave. You know how my mind works. Let me go sideways with you right now just to show you something, just to show you how this game is played. It's a dirty game. I'm going to pop in the opium trade on these same people at the same time. Check this out. The cornerstone of the colonial trade was super commodity. The commodity for Portugal had been black slaves. The commodity that drew Spain's empire was silver. The Dutch would leave. Now, this is in the same time frame. This is going on in America. These boys are so dirty. They've got tea started overtaking them as a national product. So England and Britain were spending all their money on tea. They didn't want to pay for it. So what they did, they interjected opium into the game so they could get the tea from the people. I don't understand
China,
how that works.
Right.
But opium is so devious, though. So they addicted the people in China to opium so that they could take over their market. It's deep. The emperor had to intercede, and what he did, he made a mandate to say, anybody get caught smoking this opium, off with your head. And that's what he had to do to keep his whole, because his country was going under the opium trade. They were becoming addicted. They were no good. There were no nationals anymore.
Yeah,
it's
the
deep,
opium
man. The game is deep.
It is.
Dirty.
It is. And then they tried to come back and malign them for what they've done when the real killing fields is the ones that so-called have been pushing this so-called agenda of freedom, which is not what it is at all. And it's so important. And it's deeply rooted to this day. That same Oppenheimer family that you see have been, you know, instrumental in throughout the Beers, because that's an extension of the Oppenheimer family. And it's the same institution that brought you Apple computers. And Apple itself. Everybody thought that it was Steve Jobs, but it had nothing to do with Steve Jobs. The one that really ran Apple was Peter Oppenheimer. And these are the things that we need to know, and they're there because of a reason. They're there to control you and to keep you subjugated to their demonic rituals. And that's how they control
us. Industrialists, you call them what you want. They got their own agenda, and they want something that we don't even. But we can understand it. You know, we don't have to be with it though.
Right.
I just wanted to interject it about this tea. Getting England addicted to Chinese tea was easy. Keeping the trade balance became more difficult. In 1700, the British East India Company imported 20,000 pounds of tea. 6 years later, that figure had grew to 400% to 100,000 pounds. By 1766, the cost of tea imports was becoming impossible to meet with silver. When the figure hit 6 million pounds, it became clear that tea would drain England of silver unless something was done. Up until the 18th century, drug use in the world was never described as an epidemic or plague, but the British would change that. The Chinese had discovered the pleasure of smoking opium fixed with tobacco, which was brought by the Dutch. Then in pure form, the British East India Company cornered the opium producer market and sold drugs to its willing Asians. In every Southeast Asian country where British Empire was active, the government was forced to admit Indian opium. The Chinese had the most money to spend, and their extravagance easily spread opium use. Opium was expensive to bring to the market, but China had such a large wealthy ruling class that there were enough customers who could afford to buy and use the drug on a regular basis that British East Indian Company had found a way to correct the tea trade imbalance. Today,
we're Oh, wait, right there, Brother Blackfoot, because this is so important, because what Brother Braggs is reading to you is what's happening right now. See, England hated...
Nothing is new. That's why nothing new.
Nothing is new. It's all cyclical. England hated China for a couple of reasons. One, because the establishment of the Silk Road, which China will bring back. This is why you have the BRIC nations. And I said earlier, there's a reason why those nations are in together. And it's that, and there's another defining factor that's there, why they hated them. And we're going to talk, this is something that we teach in our membership that's so, so important. All of this comes together, as you will see, is synthesized, and it comes together cyclical. They change up their routine only by name and time. They know what play to make in order to control people. And they mark China. And there's a reason why China and Russia have always been enemies. China and India have been enemies up until the point where they go into shooting wars on their borders as we speak right now. But they realize something, that they have to come together collectively against the demonic agendas that are being perpetuated by those nations that you say and consider the first-rate nations of the NATO. It's nations, out alliance. So if you only knew. And this is why we bring this stuff to you. Brother Braggs, it's put together, it comes together when you really look at it. It's like Sister David said yesterday. When you put the glasses on, you can start to see what's really happening.
You can see things, man. And sometimes we need each other to see these things. We can see even more. We get more minds, you know what I'm saying? We got black think tanks. Brothers just don't know. We are black
Man.
If we come together, man, we are unstoppable.
You see, and that is so true, Brother Braggs, because there is intrinsic value that you have. There's intrinsic value that Scotty has, Brother Davis, Sister Davis, everybody that calls into the show, Jerry, Mel, Deborah, everybody has intrinsical values. And when we put this together, that's for our design in our ways, unstoppable. But what they do, and they realize that in order for that alliance not to happen, or that collective prudence not to come into play, they have to hamstring you not one way, not two ways, not three ways, but multiple ways. And they set the whole agenda of how they control people, and they tell you how they do it because they realize that the spell has already been cast. And unless you want to break the spell, you won't be able to see the mist in which you walk in. And that is such a dangerous, dangerous thing. Okay, everyone, definitely come on in. If you'd like to if you got a question or a comment for Brother Braggs or just in general.
Hey, man, just let me finish that thought right quick, because, man, this gets deep.
Yeah, go ahead.
Today we offer to dismiss the crimes of the past simply being the way things were. British and American traders, however, should not be dismissed so lightly. They were not ignorant of what sort of substance they were selling. They knew it was poison. They knew it was addictive. In 1836, China imported enough opium to make the drug the largest revenue-producing commodity in the world. It enriched handful while destroying the social and political structure of China. By this time, the drug merchants included Americans. The great motivation, greed, was as powerful as Boston blue bloods as it was to the English. This greed is the reason the drug trade continues today, and while the Western world, specifically America and Europe, is experiencing a drug epidemic. Now, check this out. This book is 20 years old. A drug epidemic today, ironically, is the former victims of American and European colonialism that are now exporting the drugs to their ex-colonial overlords. The British and American traders who took part in what so-called China trade often had little the Chinese were willing to buy. The Chinese wanted silver and raw Indian cotton, and America and Europe wanted tea. An exception to the rule was ginseng. American ginseng produced in New England and Appalachian region was regarded as an aphrodisiac in China, but the market for ginseng was too small to balance America's demand for tea. There were two alternatives. The first was opium. The Chinese were ready consumers for opium for almost 1,000 years, but they had brewed it into tea. Like many other natural drugs, the opium tea did not cause a debilitating effect that opium smoking and opium derivatives caused. Similarly, the effect of chewing coca leaves on the Andean population of South America had some negative side effects. and nothing like the damage caused by addiction to the refined version of the plant. Cocaine in both cases refined of natural plant created a substance that created addiction. The Europeans created the opium addiction shortly after discovering the presence of tobacco in American colonies. The Dutch brought the new commodity to China. The Dutch most likely introduced both tobacco and opium smoking. The horrors of addiction quickly became known as the Chinese. In 1729, Chinese Emperor Yuan Qing prohibited the sale or use of opium in his country as anything but medicine. When the British East India Company assumed control over Bengal and Bihar, the opium producing district of India, it greedily expanded the trade. By 1767, the company was importing 2,000 chests, each filled with 170 pounds of pure opium each year. As in America, the British established trade monopolies. The Indian growers, by law, had to sell to the British East India Company, but the British love of profit was no match for the Chinese edict that company could no longer sell to China. Instead, the British East India Company became the middleman that brought the opium from the Indian producers and sold to Indians and American merchants who were willing to run the risk of shipping the product. In 1799, the Chinese Emperor Chai King made all opium trade illegal. The very act most likely served to increase the profits that were made in the trade, as both the price of opium and the amount consumed increased. The British Levant Company, another national chartered.
Hold on right there, brother. Hold on right there, because we need to tie this in with them. Scotty, are you on? Is my man Scotty on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, now Scotty, did you happen to hear some of the things what was said?
I just walked back into the room.
Okay. No problem. But check this out, and this is good. For our listeners, listen. They used the same tactics. They just renamed it. What was the problem? What did China do that was their downfall? They made a deal with the devil. They wanted something from the devil. If you want to know what happened to us, is the exact same thing that happened to China. We wanted something from the devil. And what happened? What did that devil do? The devil brought, in that practice of demonic rituals, brought drugs into their community. What do you think brought drugs into our community? It was because we wanted to deal with them. That's what brought it into our community. And if you look at just now with the Russians, when they went into Afghanistan, a lot of people don't know that their country was inundated with opium, and they went into them. That was one of the reasons why they invaded Afghanistan. What happened when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan? Did they protect or destroy those opium fields?
Well, in Afghanistan,
that's the richest opium fields in the world.
But in Afghanistan, when the Taliban was in power, they had totally eradicated the poppy fields.
That's why I wanted Scotty on. Exactly. Because they was on a mission to totally eradicate it. And what happened? Let me tell you something. Whenever people start talking about conspiracy theories and all of that, get away from those individuals, because they don't know they don't know what they're talking about. They're uneducated. Only thing that they do is watch mainstream and follow what's comfortable for them. And let me tell you something. There's nothing more deadly than a comfortable and scared individual. They will sell you out every time. Every time. So now you can see how the drugs really got into our community is because we made the fatal mistake of trying to align ourselves with the demonic rituals of the establishment. And instead of establishing our own. And there's a reason why the BRIC nations all come together the way that they have. And this is not anything new. It's ancient. And one of the things is that the establishment has a long-term plan. So do the ancient history of the Russians and the Chinese. And you're seeing this stuff play out to this day. They flooded China with opium for a reason, to destabilize and to set them back and to enslave them. What happened in our community? The exact same thing. Because we don't know history, it's bound to repeat itself, and we'll just say, no, that's not what's happening. It's critical that we start to understand and prepare for these things accordingly, and it's critical for us to come together collectively and to do the things that are necessary so that we do not try to go to sit down at the table of negotiation with those demonic agendas that are set forth. Anytime that you make a deal with the devil, you lose your soul. So Brother Braggs is putting this together so that you can see. And when you tie it all together, there's nothing new under the sun.
I want to go sideways on you one more time today. I'm going to mess you up with this one. Now check this out. This cat, Alan Smith. We're going to start off with my man. This is 1867.
So yeah, I know Alan Smith. Yeah.
The bridge popped with this cat, Parson Thomas. He had a thing called the Essay of Population. This takes us into free trade. Now check this out. A systematic depopulation policy. That's his 1867 free trade policy. In purchasing through the empire's genocidal depopulation of India, which in fact free trade is the other side of the Mathis population control coin, great famines killed more than 60 million Indians. 1770 Bengal famine, 1767 and 1770 affected the lower graphic plain of India. In each one of these 10 million people here, the Chesla famine of 1783, it killed 11 million. The Bara famine. Now, the reason I'm saying telling you about these famines, it's the same thing going all over the world right now.
And they can choke and where they killed them, Brother Brown, tell them again one more time.
The whole bit. Parched earth is a big thing because it cuts off all your food, your water, and you starve. Right. If you can't escape, you starve. So this has been going on for like 400, 500 years, but you don't know history, so you don't know that they have been wiping people of color off on this planet like it's nothing with these kind of policies. The British are some of the main ones. Man, it's deep. I'm saying I read so much about these people. It's just amazing that nobody knows this stuff. They have wiped out, decimated populations, black populations, whether it be the Aborigines on the bottom. Oh, my goodness, so many people. Aborigines here, Indians here, black Indians, because they're black Indians, like you and me, copper color people. We're everywhere. And everywhere we have been, there has been a perpetual holocaust to wipe us off the earth. I'm not going to go no more sideways, because I don't like the
There's a reason. But see, I'm glad Brother Bragg brought that portion up. See, I didn't know what Brother Bragg was going to be talking about today at all, you know. But I'm glad that you did. But what country were those mass murders perpetuating, that genocide was perpetuating?
All in India. Britain. They tore them off. Look, by the time they got through from 1867 to 6 million in Indian famine of 1869, 6 million died. The Bengal famine. 3.5 million died.
Exactly.
All of these times, the Chesapeake famine affected many parts of India. 11 million died. You just hear these numbers I'm running off. But these people have, that's why you have these great monuments with no people. Because when they came, the invaders came, they killed off the indigenous for the land.
And you know, they had it. Oh, go ahead, brother. Sorry.
But I was going to say they had rules that if you came to a place and it was uninhabited, it may have been a habit when they got there, but when they left, it was uninhabited because they killed off all the people. They could claim that land as free land.
Exactly. And that's what you have here, and when you look throughout history, when you see some of the ancient people that have been totally annihilated and they're no longer here, is that's because they were marked by these individuals for extinction. And you can see how they do it. Guess what? The same tactics that have been done before in the past are being displayed right now through the poisoning of the water. There's an agenda behind all of this. There is an agenda behind all of this. And if you look at India, what is India a part of now? Part of BRICS. Yep. There's a lot of reasons why these individuals have established themselves, because they know the history and what they're fighting up against. What was the one nation that their Supreme Court has brought charges against the Gates Foundation for its vaccination that has been known to kill people, and they want to have crimes against humanity charges against them, where the so-called Melinda and Bill can't go there because they'll be arrested. But right. See, here in this country,
50,000 children were disabled by this vaccination. That's why they can't go there.
You praised out Exactly. We praise and admire them. So all through, we fall for the fraudulent activities of these individuals, not knowing what they're all about, because it's not popular for us to know the things that don't entertain us, but strengthen us. We have fallen into the comatose state of entertainment. We so often want to be entertained. Let me tell you something. The joke is on you. The joke is on us. And it's on us because of what we've allowed, the mist of the spell that they've cast on us, to continue to infirm and fill our lungs so that we breathe this. And I'm going to tell you something else. Everything that they give you is a poison pill. Brother Brax, we got like 2 minutes left. And just want to, if there's any callers, you got any questions or comments that you want to make, definitely give us a call, 641-715-3660. And the participant code is 549032 pound. Hit star 61 and I'll see you in queue and bring you up right away. You know, Brother Rags, we didn't even get to talk about the capital controls, but that's okay, because this is the controls of the people. And I always say, man, that the first, you know, that having blind faith is the first misstep towards genocide. This is why. This is why when you have blind faith, you made the first step, the first misstep towards genocide. These people are, they don't know the power of love. They love power. And they follow these rituals, and they establish these well-funded organizations because they know that these well-funded organizations will deceive you to where you will want to participate in it, and you'll look up and admire them. And one of the first things that happens when you admire something other than what's admirable, you lose a portion of yourself, and you take on that same evilness that in which you admire exemplifies. And you wonder why we act the way we do. It's because we've lost our direction and we've walked away from what is true and sincere. Let me tell you something. What they put in front of you and they fully fund, you should be running away from. And it's easy to tell because they tell you everything. We just don't know the language. Listen, we got a caller that's in queue, Brother Braggs. Let's take this caller before we get out of here.
Bet.
Welcome, caller, to Tando Radio Show. What is your name? Where are you calling from? And what is your question or comment?
Hey, what's up, brothers? How y'all
doing? What's up, Brother Mel?
Peace.
Good. Thank you for all the information, Brother Bragg. Brother
Jay. Yo, peace, man.
I wanted to ask you what the name of that movie was. It reminded me like of that garlic effect, that, you know, on that clip. And it's like the reverse garlic. What was that movie that Sister Davis was talking about last night?
Oh, I can't. I don't know. I'm not a movie watcher.
He's talking about the movie with the gut where you put the glasses on.
Yeah, with the glasses on, you can see. Yeah. Sister, what was it that Sister? Sister Davis. Oh man, what was it? And it was. Oh wait.
They
it was
live.
With Rowdy Piper, because Sister Davis.
They
told
live.
Me, I remember right. It. Huh?
They live.
They live.
They live.
They live. Thank you, Scotty. Right.
They live.
Right.
I want to see what she's talking about.
Yeah.
But okay, that's
old movie
what I,
too.
I want to see. And
yeah,
I
it's
also,
an old movie. It's an old movie. I remember seeing I knew that Roddy Piper was in it. But yeah, real good, and I'm glad Sister Davis brought that up. So definitely, if you can, man. I'm not one to do movies. But just be careful when you watch movies, in my opinion, because what happens is that you're watching somebody's mind tease, and they put you in a coma, you know, they put you in a comatose state, to where you're actually surrendering a part of your thinking to them. It's, you know, you're put in a catatonic state, and that's very, very, but if you're aware of that, it won't affect you the way of that. This is why you always have to be in control of your mind. Never, ever, ever, because there's a spirit that goes along with all of that stuff. This is why Hollywood has been so effective, and Hollywood has been so influential, is because they've casted a spell, and they tell you everything. You got these shows now, Lucifer. That's on right now.
Somebody told me that yesterday, man. A show called Lucifer. Now I don't look at TV. I was like, what?
And they're so blatant in the hope, because what they do is they say, oh, no, it's just a show. And the only thing that they're showing you is that you're going to be giving up. They're showing you what they're going to be doing to you, and not only that, what you're going to be surrendering to. Let me tell you something. It's a methodical approach that they take to your destruction. While we just don't even look about and to design our own prosperity, so we're bound to fall for the trap. When they lay the trap and bait the trap, we always walk into it. And one of the things I always say is we walk into it. We're the only ones that once the cage, once we've been in captured and our freedom has been taken, they can open the door and we won't run out because we'll claim our cage as our home. And that's a real problem.
Yeah, brother, I hear you. Thank you, man, for that. But when I watch television, man, it's more like research. I have my glasses on already.
See, you're thinking, and it's a difference, and that's what, be careful when you watch it. You know, it's a matter of education, and it's a matter of discerning what is being there, and then you won't be able to be put into a catatonic state. Don't believe me? Watch people that watch TV. You'll see that their mouth is open. They're totally...
Mouth hanging open.
Mouth hanging open, and they're totally in a comatose state.
Hey, that's why they call them zombies, man. They call them TV zombies because they in the trance and they don't even realize it. They don't even realize that they act out things they see subconsciously. Your subconscious is never asleep. You may be asleep, but your subconscious super ego is always wide awake. And it's feeding,
because it's eternal.
A sponge.
Exactly. It's a sponge. And it's eternal. Hey, everyone. Right. I just want to thank you all for a great show. Brother Bragg, as always. Scotty, thank you so much. Please. Brother Mel, thank you so much for being you and all of the Tando Radio listeners. Thank you for being who you are, and let's continue to grow. If you like to get in on a $25 membership, you can email me at wolf6pack1@gmail.com or text me at 951-790-8330. Much love and much respect. We're out of here. God willing, until later on, it's never goodbye. As always, I'll see you later. And before you ask for a blessing, make sure to be a blessing. Peace, peace, much love, much respect.
Peace.
Peace.
Girl, you are rich, even with nothing. You know tenderness comes from pain. It's amazing how you love. Love is kind, love can give and get no gain. It's down a rugged road you've come. Though you had every reason, you didn't come undone. Somehow you made it to the other side. You didn't suffer in vain. You forgive those who have trespassed against you.